Coming at the end of the day, this has been a very interesting day, a long day. So I always worry about being slotted in the afternoon to see the fading audiences, the heads nodding off. So I'm going to try to keep it a bit lively and maybe a bit provocative for you all. My name is Gawain Kripke. I'm, as the introduction said, I'm the policy director at Oxfam America. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here. It's been a really interesting session, and especially Bayer Crop Sciences, of course, for hosting this and giving us a chance to bring out these issues. First, just a couple words about Oxfam, so you know who I am and who we are. We're a nonprofit agency. I work in Washington, D.C., that's dedicated to creating lasting solutions to hunger, poverty, and social injustice. We do humanitarian response when emergencies happen around the world. We do longer-term development partnerships in developing countries, and we mobilize public and private resources towards those ends. We're a nonprofit, we're independent, we don't take government funds, so we're not influenced by the U.S. government, and we're part of a confederation of organizations around the world operating in about 90 countries. Our business model is essentially to raise money as a from philanthropies and from individuals as donations, and then use that funds for humanitarian and development purposes. So just so you know who I am and where I'm coming from. Today I want to talk about the big challenge. The big challenge of the mid-century, around 2050, when the global population is estimated to be 9 billion people. Their recent population estimates have actually been revised upwards, so that by the end of the century, we may have something closer to 11 billion people. As important as the total number of people is that people are getting richer, which is creating increasing pressure on resources and increasing demand on food. So we've heard in some of the earlier sessions about demand growth globally. And even while demand has been growing because of population and because of income growth, we see that agricultural productivity has been rising, but there's a wedge being drawn between productivity growth and population and income growth. And so we saw these enormous increases in productivity in the earlier part of the, or in the middle part of the 20th century, but those increases have tapered off. And many argue that this is the result of a significant decline in public and private investment in agricultural research. So this wedge between rising demand and productivity that's not as fast as it has been is creating pressure generally on the markets, and we see that reflected in food prices. So this chart shows food prices over the last two decades, more or less, and you see a general rising trend that accelerates towards the end of this decade. And we see that drop off. You've all seen other charts like this both today and elsewhere. But the theme is that food prices are generally rising, and at the same time, they're becoming more volatile. And these are two different but related problems, and both of them are very important for our mission. Food prices are generally expected to rise. Now, anyone who makes a prediction about the future is probably going to be proved wrong, and I've spent enough time with economists to be skeptical of any certainty, but we Oxfam did do some modeling to try to make some estimates on where we think food prices are going. And the dark green bar is the best guesses about what different commodity prices might be in 2030, about 20 years from now. So you see significant price increases in maize and rice and other commodities. The light green bar is if you put an overlay of climate change as an obstacle to agricultural production. And any of these estimates can be disputed and debated, but just to give a sense of what the impact of climate change might be on food production and therefore on food prices, this is a very scary graph. It shows that food prices might actually be dramatically higher in the future, within 20 years, if predictions about climate change are true, and if predictions about income and population growth are also true. Now, the reason we talk about food prices is because we care about hunger. Most people think of hunger as a lack of food, and indeed, people that suffer from hunger, malnutrition, or undernutrition, don't get enough food. But the reason that they don't get enough food isn't because there is no food in markets where they live. It's more because they don't have the money or the income to afford buying good food or enough food. So prices really matter if you're concerned about reducing hunger globally. And this map is meant to show the impact, the role of food on household budgets. Green areas on the map are where household budgets, food makes up a relatively small part of household budgets. So in the United States, the average American household's food budget is around 10% of income. But in developing countries, and especially the poorest countries, food might make up 50 or 60 or even more of a household income budget. So when food prices go up, that has a real shock to household budgets, and as a result, means increasing hunger. Because if food is making up 50% of your budget and food prices have risen 25 or 50 or 100%, that means you have to go without food, or go without other important services like healthcare or education. In many of these countries, education is not provided as a free government provided service, but people have to pay for it, and so children don't get educated, or they don't get food, or some of both. So food prices matter a lot to poor people, and they matter more to poor people than to rich people, and they matter more in poor countries than in rich countries. Oh, I'm going backwards. Now, I mentioned hunger because these food price increases have been, economists have tried to make estimates on what these food price increases have done to global hunger. And this chart is meant to try to map what hunger has done over the last few years. And in 2009, the best guess was that the number of hungry people around the world broke the 1 billion mark. And this chart, if it went back decades, would show a very, very long, slow decline in the absolute number of hungry people around the world. And this very sad trail off in which the line starts rising in the latter part of the last decade. So hunger is on the increase. These are estimates. These are projections based on models. And yet we think they're true, that there probably are more hungry people today than there were a few years ago. And this is a major challenge. Now, I talked about the challenge, the food price challenge and the productivity challenge. But note that there's almost a billion people hungry even before all that, even in the salad days of the 90s when food prices were relatively low and there were surpluses that people didn't know how to manage. There's a lot of hungry people. So it's not just food supply that's important, but it's also food access, as we say. I talked about the impact of climate change on prices. And this is a map that's, again, just an estimate or best guess. The science on this is very murky, but it's an effort to try to map where climate change will have the biggest impacts on agriculture production. And remember that most poor people are themselves agriculturalists. So this impacts their livelihoods and their access to food, both through production itself and through buying food in markets, because they make their wages through agriculture. And you see this very sad correlation between hunger and poverty and where climate change is likely to impact agriculture production. Of course, most of the poorest people rely on the weather for agriculture and their livelihood. They don't have irrigated lands, so when the weather goes crazy, they lose their livelihoods. And there are some regions that actually potentially could benefit from climate change in the northern latitudes. But around that belt, around the equator, we see very red map. And so This is the challenge we think we're facing. So we look at this picture, and we see what we think is a global food system that has very serious challenges. We have this overall production challenge that, with income and population growth, we must increase our overall food production. And the UN estimates that by mid-century, we'll need to increase global food production by about 70% to meet demand. At the same time, we have an ecological challenge. We see climate change impacting. We have to reduce the climate footprint of agriculture. Agriculture is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and it's also, of course, it will likely be quite impacted by changes in climate. So this ecological challenge, and that's only climate change. Of course, we have water and many other environmental challenges within agriculture. We have this equity challenge that even if we did meet the overall production supply, there's no guarantee that the poorest people, the billion at the bottom that aren't getting enough food, will get the food. And lastly, a resilience challenge. If we're facing a more volatile future with higher prices and more volatile weather, we need to build in some insurance, some ways of managing this volatility going forward, and probably new tools are needed for that. I'm going backwards again. For Oxfam, since our mission is around poverty, we have tried to frame this issue for ourselves in terms of thinking about who we're trying to focus on. And we've settled on trying to think about small food producers in developing countries, especially women. And women make up a very large portion of the farming population in developing countries and are the most vulnerable often to both climate impacts, market impacts, social impacts of different kinds. They often have less labor to contribute because they have to take care of household members. So thinking about what will make their livelihoods and their food security better is a useful prism for thinking about poverty and hunger generally. And here you see a picture of a warehousing project that Oxfam is supporting in Ghana, trying to provide women agriculturalists secure warehouses so that they can store their commodities. Earlier we talked about food waste. Well, in many developing countries, this issue of post-harvest loss, the wastage of food in the fields and in transportation is a major issue. And farmers have to sell low and buy high, and so trying to provide better resources for them is a critical issue. To meet these challenges, Oxfam is developing concepts and a campaign, which we call GROW, which is meant to try to address simultaneously many of these problems at once. And it's a global campaign, so as we launch it not just in the United States and Europe, but also in many developing countries, because many of the problems have to be dealt with on the ground and in developing countries. So we have set these as our objectives, to try to be responsive to some of the issues that I've raised in the first half of this presentation. So first is to recognize that we all have to act together, and we need to build movements globally to recognize the issues around food security and agriculture production and the distribution and fairness of the system. So we want to work with others in the private sector, in the public sector, in the civil society sector, all around the world to, first of all, elevate these issues of hunger and poverty and then try to build alliances to deal with them. Because of the rising prices of agriculture commodities and the inputs to agriculture, we're observing that there are some real problems emerging in many developing countries. The foremost problem that we're seeing on the ground is land and water grabs, where local or international entities are coming in and securing land and often displacing local communities and farmers. And this is a really critical issue, we think, for these women farmers who often lack formal land tenure and so forth. So this is, we've identified this as a short-term and very important issue to begin addressing. Another area of work is around climate change. I mentioned it. We need to both try to prevent climate change where possible, but also prepare for it. There's almost no amount of work we can do that will stop some amount of climate change happening. It's happening, and we might as well recognize that and get ready for it. And so on the one hand, we want to mitigate climate change, which is the term used to try to prevent future climate change. And on the other hand, we have to adapt. We have to get ready because it's coming. And we need to develop new technologies and strategies for agriculture and food security that recognize climate change is coming. We want to invest in these poorest and most vulnerable food producers who are themselves often food insecure during certain times of the year or when droughts come or when there are shocks to the system, either from the climate or from markets. And so we want to we need to bring more investment and market attention to their productivity, to their resilience, and to their sustainability. And we do want to focus on women in particular. And last, we need to recognize that the world has probably changed. We probably are seeing rising prices in the future. We probably are seeing more volatile prices. We probably are seeing more weather events, droughts and floods. And rather than hoping it doesn't happen, we should prepare for it and get our humanitarian system working better so that we can do earlier action, which is less costly and more effective. For the United States, since that's where I am and most of us do our work, we've developed a more specific agenda for action. And this is where I'll probably provoke some reactions from the audience. So first, the U.S. is a significant contributor of foreign aid in different sectors. And so we want to make sure that the United States continues to play a positive role in public investment in small producers and women. And the Obama administration has launched quite an important initiative in this area called the Feed the Future Initiative, which is meant to focus on small producers of you know, agriculture producers and bring more investment to them. The Obama administration has more than doubled the foreign aid dedicated to this cause, and yet it's still a drop in the budget. Over 3 years, it's about $3.5 billion. Sounds like a lot, but in the overall scheme of the federal budget, it's not that big. And it's under a lot of pressure with the federal budget as it is, and pressure on all parts of federal budget. So we feel like this is a critical element of the agenda, given that public investment in agriculture and in agriculture research has declined dramatically over the last three decades. So there's very little money coming from any governments, including the United States, to focus on agriculture and especially small producers. So that's number one. With the run-up of food prices, there's been a lot more interest in commodity markets. And many of you will have observed this and heard about some of the debates and controversies on this. There's some objective facts, which is that hundreds of billions of dollars have moved into commodity markets over the last few years, seeking safe harbor or to hedge against other markets. When the dot-com industry collapsed, money moved into real estate, and after real estate, now moving into commodities. So we see this flight of capital, but that movement creates bubbles and creates pathologies in those markets. And well, we believe, based on our best guess, that the deregulation of agriculture commodities markets and this flood of capital into them has created more volatility, probably has created bubbles and instability, and we think it's time to pull that back. Most of you will know that the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation did mandate that new regulations be developed, and those are in process right now. So I talked about the future that has more emergencies, is likely to have more droughts. Last year we had a famine, which is a technical description of hunger, when a certain number of people are dying from hunger. And the UN declared a famine in parts of Somalia. And really the whole region of East Africa was afflicted by a terrible drought. And a lot of people were made food insecure. And best guesses are tens of thousands of people, mostly children, died. So the thing is that there was ample warning of this. More than a year in advance, it was becoming clear that the rains weren't coming and there was drought. And yet donors, including the United States, and I have to say including Oxfam, didn't respond adequately. We didn't bring food in, we didn't do livelihood projects, we didn't shift direction. And a lot of the misery that this drought has caused was probably avoidable if we'd taken action sooner, if we paid attention to our own information that we had about the drought. So recognizing that we probably have the tools, we just don't use them. We don't spend the money wisely. We react rather than prevent. These are all issues that we think are really important going forward. And to start with, Oxfam thinks that we should start with our food aid system. The U.S. is an enormously generous food aid contributor. We give more food aid than any other country by far. We give about half the world's food aid. And food aid, of course, in drought situations, is a critical resource. It keeps people alive. And yet we do it in perhaps the most inefficient way you could think of. Regulations and restrictions basically mean we lose about 30% of the food aid budget to various special interests and to bureaucracy. We also delay our delivery of food aid probably about 4 or 5 months, which can be important time when people are facing crisis. So modernizing our food aid system becomes a critical piece of our agenda here. And then we've already heard people, some of the debate around biofuels and ethanol. And you'll know these figures already. This won't be new to you, about the diversion of our corn harvest into energy. So to some extent, the genie's out of the bottle. I think ethanol markets in the future are going to be mostly driven by oil prices. And oil prices being high are just going to draw corn and ethanol into the market because it's arguably competitive with gasoline at these prices. But we don't need taxpayers and the federal government driving that market. At this point, corn ethanol can probably stand on its own, and we can take back the subsidies, which expired this year for most of corn ethanol, and the mandates for corn ethanol. At the least, we should do one of these off-ramp provisions that this previous speaker talked about, that when corn stocks are low, we ought to relax these mandates that are forcing ethanol production and forcing the accommodation to high prices onto other sectors, onto consumers, onto the livestock industry, and many others. So the only sector that doesn't adjust when prices go high for corn is the ethanol sector currently. And last, we need to take action on these displaced people. This is a photograph of children who are drawing pictures of the land, of their houses where they used to live after a British company came in and kicked them off their farms in Uganda. And this is happening all over the developing world, but in particular in Africa. Now, in many of these countries, land rights are very ambiguous, and legal frameworks don't exist, and so people are very vulnerable to this kind of speculation in land. The best guess is that about 80% of the investments in land that are coming in from foreign entities are just being held to hold the land. They're not making productive investments in agriculture. They're just holding the land as a speculative investment. But in the meantime, they are depriving other users, the local communities, of using that land for their own use and for food production. So we think this is a growing problem and needs to be addressed, mainly by asking private sector actors, investment managers and companies, the World Bank and others, to develop better standards and implement them. So this is our agenda in the United States. And I put it out there maybe to spark some conversation. And we have launched this campaign. We intend to be doing this campaign for something like 4 or 5 years, because we want to try to make some change in that time period. And we think that this is a good time with these issues in the news more than they have been, with some opportunity, political opportunity, to bring new resources and new attention to these issues. But without sticking with it for some years, maybe even decades, we don't think it's going to be possible to make change. And to recognize that that no single solution really makes will solve these problems. Multiple solutions will have to be brought into place. But to recognize that a simple analysis, like that global food production needs to increase, doesn't necessarily solve the problem of hunger, for example. If people... there can be food on markets, but people don't have access to it. So bringing a new approach towards hunger and livelihoods is really critical. And many of the solutions being proposed in earlier times don't really recognize that. And so we need to innovate and think more carefully about how to address the poorest and most vulnerable people. Okay, I'll stop there. Maybe we can have some discussion.